Well, happy Thursday and welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. Hope you've had a great week and that the holiday shopping is going well and that you're getting all the preparations in line for what I'm sure will be the best of all possible holidays. We're going to step away from our winter pledge drive for just a little bit to bring you something of great note and import to folks here in Florida's Capital County. And before we get underway, a reminder, you're always invited to be part of Perspectives via phone and email by calling 414-1234. That's the local number. 800-926-8809 is long distance from you to us, and Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address if that is your preferred form of communication. Or if you're one of them, there are Twitter folks, just at WFSU Perspective. That'll get you right on to us. You know, even old-time Tallahasseans may be just a touch hazy on the very early history of our area, especially when it comes to the names of the people who had a big impact on those long ago times, and by extension, the times we live in too, because they're all connected, right? Well, one of those names is Benjamin Chairs, and I guess most of us can probably make the connection between that name and the little town of Chairs out in the east part of the county that also bears the name. But the saga of Benjamin Chairs is the subject now of a new book coming out called Whispers of Verdura, The Legacy of Benjamin Chairs by Sharon Hyland Shields, who spent a lot of her career working at the Division of Historic Resources in the Florida Department of State and is bringing the results of all that research and great scholarship to us today. Sharon, thanks for coming on and telling us about your book today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You're also joined by an old friend of ours, no stranger to these microphones, because a little bit over a year ago, when we talked about another tome that covered local history, he was here to help us out with that. From the History Department of Tallahassee Community College, a true historian, in the words of one of his many students, Professor Bob Holliday. Bob, good to see you.
Oh, my goodness. What flattery will get you everywhere.
Well, thank you, Tom. In case I want to go back to school and take a history course of yours, I checked to see what your students were saying about you. And
oh, no.
You got some fans out there, sir.
Oh, no. Wait till their final exams get graded. Yeah. Then we'll see.
Then we won't be able to probably share those comments in mixed company. Hey, Before we get into Sharon and her book here, the significance of this guy, Benjamin Chairs, because until you contacted me about Sharon's book, I thought, well, yeah, I knew that there was a Benjamin Chairs, but I really didn't think anything much of this guy. He was a pretty significant historic figure around here.
He was. I mean, he was, for example, very heavily involved in railroad construction, early banking. He was a member of something called the Nucleus, which was an 1820s and 1830s pro-Andrew Jackson political coalition that involved people like Richard Keith Call and William Duvall, both governors and so forth of the state. And Benjamin Chairs, I guess he slipped a little bit through the cracks because he died relatively early in 1838, one of the fairly frequent yellow fever epidemics, I think, at the time. But he's a significant local figure. I mean, he's Sharon. This is a book that's needed to be done for quite some time. And Sharon has done, I think, marvelous research here and produced a very fine book.
Yeah, because most of us think in terms of, okay, 1824, the two riders, one from Pensacola, the other from St. Augustine, met down where Cascades Park is and said, hey, what a great place for a state capital. Look, a waterfall, which we, of course, no longer have. Thank you, Seaboard Coastline. And then we had the Civil War, and then we're here. And that's kind of the way. Sharon, what fascinated you about this particular part of our murky history here in Tallahassee?
Well, it started when I was in the graduate program in historic archaeology. And my thesis was on Benjamin Chairs's plantation, which is called Verdura. And Verdura means green. And the thesis itself was on the site, the plantation site, but I also had to do a little bit of research on the person who built it. And I just couldn't find anything. There wasn't hardly anything in the published record. The occasional reference to his being the first millionaire in Florida, an occasional reference to his grand mansion, but really nothing of any depth. So after I finished the thesis, I just kept looking and kept doing research, and people knew I was interested, so they would pass me little tidbits that they would find. And after I retired from the state, I was getting kind of bored, and I thought, well, I need to do something productive, something interesting. And in my thesis, I had recommended that somebody do a biography of Benjamin Chairs. Well, in all those years since then, nobody did. So I thought, well, I'm not a historian. I'm not much of an archaeologist. I'm not a writer. But I think I'll give it a shot. And so I just started going back to the archives, back digging deeper, and finally decided it was time to put it together.
Well, my gosh, since such a definitive historical account really didn't exist, and you had to piece it together. What, you go back and you look at old land deeds and and even personal correspondence, maybe, that people said, oh, here was a letter from Benjamin Chairs,
yes,
that I found, and things like that?
Anything. But the archives, I mean, I guess I started with the census records first and found out that he had 10 children. And then from there, I found out that he had 35 grandchildren. And who were they? What did they do? There was nothing about them. So I had to look at old newspaper clippings, just about anything in the archives that you could think of, court records, deed records, probate records, old maps, anything.
God, how long did this take to compile all of this?
About 20 years.
Wow. That's really good detective work there, Bob. I mean, that's really what historians do, is just reconstruct the past from these little bits and shards and fragments that are floating around out
it
there.
It is, Tom. Benjamin Chairs is one of those people who we know a little bit about because he gets mentioned in other people's books and research. For example, he was mentioned briefly in Ed Baptist's book on creating an Old South, about the creation of Leon and Jackson counties. Then he's mentioned a little bit more prominently in James Denham's book this year, the first biography of William Duval. They were heavily, you know, they were sort of friends and so forth. And so, as Sharon said, it's like putting a puzzle together. I mean, and it literally is like I mean, there's still questions, you know. You never answer every question, but you piece together enough that you can create a narrative.
Well, Sharon, where did Benjamin Chairs come from? Because if he died in 1838, as Bob said, that was just 14 years after really the founding of Tallahassee. So he obviously, you know, wasn't born here. Where'd he come from?
Well, he was born in North Carolina. His family had come into the country on the eastern shores of Maryland, and so his ancestors were established there. And then his grandfather moved down to North Carolina, and he was born there in 1786. From there, the family, his parents, his older half-brother, and other siblings moved to Louisville, Georgia. And his father was active in politics there because, of course, Georgia was just getting settled. A lot of land was being sold in land lotteries. And that was where Benjamin Chairs had his first experience with purchasing large tracts of land. And then he married Sarah Powell in Milledgeville, Georgia. And after that, he began to sort of wander. And he wandered over to Savannah and Amelia Island, Jacksonville, St. Augustine. And he started buying up huge tracts of land there as well. So then he started going back and forth from Georgia to the coast of to the coastal part of Georgia and also East Florida. So he became very well known in St. Augustine. He was a president of the Board of Aldermen. He was very involved with the politics over there. And so he moved his family to St. Augustine. And then he began to wander again, and he wandered over toward Middle Florida and Leon County, and first settled in Magnolia, which was down on the St. Marks River. He was one of the first commissioners of the Bank of Magnolia, and eventually he again followed his pattern of buying large tracts of land and eventually bought the land where Verdura is. He ultimately had almost 10,000 acres of land just in Leon County.
10,000 acres? Good Lord.
And his largest purchase of land was down near Ocala, 20,000 acres down there, which had been a Spanish land grant. And so the Spanish land grants were very poorly surveyed, and they were in the courts for many, many years. And his particular 20,000 acres from in the Ocala area was in the courts, both district courts and Supreme Court, federal Supreme Court, for about 50 years before it was settled. And, of course, that was long after he died.
Well, all this land, of course, not being used for subdivisions like it would be today in major residential developments, but this was plantation land, wasn't it, Bob?
Yeah, this was part of what we call the Cotton Kingdom. And, of course, Florida became part of that with the Adams-Onis Treaty in 1821, where it came from Spain and so forth, because when Spain owned it, for example, there was no slavery here. But once the United States got it, it immediately legalized slavery here in the whole Gulf Coast area from eastern Georgia, the Panhandle, of course, all the way through Alabama, Mississippi, and into eastern Texas became part of what we call the Cotton Kingdom. And my favorite description of the economic possibilities of this area in the first half of the 19th century comes from my friend Catherine Mooney, who teaches history at FSU. She says, you want a parallel to this? Think of Silicon Valley, like the dot-com revolution. I mean, you get some land, you get some slaves, you plant some cotton, and cotton is in such demand that you are on your way. And that's right.
And that's why Benjamin Shares, just in the parlance of so many folks who know, was the first millionaire in Florida.
Well, that's an undocumented statement.
Well, we'll see if we can shed some additional light on this evolving saga as we go. Talking about a historic figure here in Tallahassee and Leon County, Benjamin Shares. And your comments are welcome, too, at 414-1234 or 800-926-8809 as Perspectives continues. Welcome back to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. Tom Flanagan along with you. And our guest today, Bob Holliday from the TCC Department of History and author Sharon Hyland Shields, who has written a book called Whispers of Verdura, The Legacy of Benjamin Shares, which is coming out pretty soon, right?
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Any day now.
We hope in time for your holiday gift giving, but where will that be available to? We'll put that out there periodically throughout the show. How are we going
to
get a hold
of it? The easiest way to get it it's being published by Century Press, of which I'm also managing editor. Century Press, as you know, was founded by Dr. William Warren Rogers at FSU. The best way right now is to send me an email to centurypress@gmail.com and tell me that you want one, and you will be on the list, because this initial print run, we're only doing 400 copies of this. That's because technology allows us to sort of test the market and so forth. 100 hardbacks, which will sell for $35, $30, which will sell for $30, and 300 paperbacks, which will sell for $15. So get on the list, and you will be notified when it is ready. My guess is that it will sell out so quickly that it may not be in any stores, although I can't say that because we're certainly going to attempt to place it in retail establishments. But right now, send me centurypress@gmail.com, and you will be put on the list.
For a very rare edition of a book on local history that fills in a lot of the gaps that we have in the early part of our history here in Tallahassee. Well, after he moved from the Carolinas down through Georgia, eventually St. Augustine, and then out here into the Panhandle to settle in the Tallahassee area. Talk about this plantation, this fabulous verdura which traces of which I understand still remain, right?
Yes, Sharon? That's correct. There are remains of the mansion, remains of the kitchen, detached kitchen, remains of a storage room that was adjacent to the kitchen.
It burned in the 1880s.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As so many of them did, yeah.
And the family cemetery is also present, although somewhat overgrown with vegetation. No one really knows what the parameters of the plantation were. The will, Benjamin Chares' will, said that he would leave 500 acres to his wife. So that's, if you interpret it to mean that was where the activities of the plantation took place, the house and the probably blacksmith shops and slave quarters or whatever, were probably within that 500-acre delineation. But in terms of out of the almost 10,000 acres of land that he held, we don't know how much of that he perceived to be verdura. So, and he also owned another plantation up the road a piece called Fauntleroy, which eventually his son and grandson owned. But exactly what was verdura, we don't really know. We know the land that he owned, whether he thought that was part of his big plantation or a separate plantation. We have not been able to figure that out.
And his son-in-law, is that right, owned Southwood?
George Ward, who was a Confederate hero from Tallahassee, who died in the Battle of Williamsburg, was married to one of Benjamin's daughters, Sarah Jane, and he already had Southwood Plantation, but another 1,000 acres was added to it when she married George.
And this whole area was a patchwork of plantations, Southwood, Verdura, Walani, all of these, and you go from one to the other.
Right.
I mean, all this land was owned. This wasn't wilderness, right?
You look at Clifton Paisley's book, The Red Hills of Florida, and he's got a map in there of just how dense the plantations were in Leon County, and it's amazing.
I mean, and they weren't all necessarily large. There were plantations that were just a few acres. somebody may have had one or two slaves. They were part of the system, but not nearly on the scale that the chairs were. I mean, not only did Benjamin Chairs have huge amounts of land, he had two brothers that came here with him, Tom Peter and Green Hill Chairs. And actually, the community of Chairs is named for Green Hill Chairs.
Green Hill Chairs and not Benjamin
right,
Chairs.
Right, because he donated land for the railroads and for schools. And it was much later, after Benjamin was long gone, that the community of Chairs was named that.
One of the ironic things about Verdura is that, and there's only one drawing of the house that I have ever seen before it burned, and it truly is magnificent. But I don't think Benjamin even lived there for very long.
He would have lived there probably at most about 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is any of the family left in this area?
Any of his family?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, probably. You probably know people that are descended from the Chairs, the original Chairs. Mm-hmm. I mean, he alone had 35 grandchildren, and it just keeps getting more exponentially. So, I know quite a few Chairs descendants that are direct descendants of Benjamin Chairs.
Sharon spoke at the Tallahassee Historical Society about a month ago, and there were a number of members of the family there, and they've been very supportive of this project.
Wow, I imagine so. Golly, I wish I knew as much about my family as we now know about.
I don't know as much about my own family as I do about the Chairs.
It sounds like a good next project here for you, Sharon. Fred joins us at 414-1234, the number
Fred.
To call, as we talk about the legacy and the history of Benjamin Chairs. Hi, Fred. Welcome to Perspectives.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
First, I'd like to commend Ms. Shields for undertaking this research. Despite its importance in the history of frontier Florida, very little has been written about the role of Benjamin Chairs, and I believe her upcoming book will fill this void very nicely. My question to her is twofold. First, and you briefly touched on this, is the claim that Benjamin Chairs was Florida's first millionaire, and I'm wondering if Ms. Shields has uncovered any evidence to support this claim. And secondly, there is a dark side to the accumulation of wealth by Chairs. He was a very large slaveholder, and I'm wondering if this aspect of the story will be addressed in her book. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much, Fred. Really appreciate that. So let's start with that claim of first millionaire in Florida, Sharon, that's been bandied about so aggressively here.
Well, it sort of depends on how you define millionaire. If you're talking about cold, hard cash, or if you're talking about savings accounts in the bank, or if you're talking about land and slaves, for which we know the landscape. Well, that should be plural, landscapes that he owned and, for the most part, I think worked as a planter. But we don't really know the absolute value of the land that he had. Some of the deeds tell you how much he paid. Some of the deeds tell you whether it was a mortgage or cash. Or sometimes they would pay in slaves. Well, how do you calculate that? There are some slave records that tell you a slave that was healthy and strong would be worth a lot more than, say, an older female slave. So to find the values of each of these things, first of all, it's very difficult to locate it. Secondly, you don't know how it translates to possibly today's values. So when I tried to say, okay, he was Florida's first millionaire, who said so first? Who decided that? And how did they know? The bank records are pretty much destroyed, the early bank records from that period, because there was so much skullduggery going on with money, politics, railroads, banks, the nucleus. All of these things were factored together. And so there's not a way to go back and look at bank records and see, well, how much did Ben have in his checking account? Well, they didn't have checking accounts. They used the banks primarily to move funds from one entity to another. For example, to take it from a plantation owner's savings or whatever he had to invest and put it into railroads or put it into banks or put it into land. It was more of a transferal of funds. It wasn't so much an investment of funds the way we think of it.
Sure. But if you even look at just the $10,000 of acreage in Leon County in contemporary terms, of course, that would be multi-million dollar worth. But it didn't translate directly back in those days to what that would be worth in a comparable way.
Right.
But that's how you measured net worth back then in the South, land and slaves. That's how you measured what somebody was worth.
Well, that brings us to the second point then that Fred had, you know, that horrible legacy of slavery. And how do you handle that in the context of the book, Sharon? Just that, you know, here was a bad guy, he owned all these slaves?
No. I don't look at it as bad guy, good guy, because they lived in different times. They had different standards. Their culture was different. We think slavery is terrible. We wouldn't consider it. A normal human being wouldn't do that. But back then, it was normal to have slaves. And so I don't think that we should judge them morally for something that we really have no firsthand experience with.
My favorite piece of research that Sharon uncovered for this book, and I agree with that, by the way. I do think, though, that it's I think Benjamin shares, along with most slave owners, was coarsened by the institution of slavery. My favorite piece of research that she uncovered is the narrative of a young man named Amos Dresser. Amos Dresser was a student at Oberlin University, which was a hotbed of abolitionist anti-slavery sentiment. And Amos Dresser, in 1835, came south to various communities and confronted slave owners. And he was not very well received. In Nashville, for example, he was literally tied to a tree and flogged until he left town. But we came to Tallahassee, and we're pretty sure that he has an interview with George Ward, who is the son-in-law of Benjamin Chairs. And he asks, you know, about the institution of slavery, and George Ward is very bland about this. He says, yeah, ho-hum, yawn, slaves are treated brutally and so forth, ho-hum, but, you know, we need to do it because it increases cotton production. Yawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a part of our history that we have trouble wrapping our brains around today, how this was even possible and how you could ho-hum this kind of thing given the modern sensibility that we have now. But then that didn't exist then.
Well, it's right. A classic example, and it's not the only time in American history where something is both perfectly legal and constitutional but also immoral at the same time.
Yeah. Let's go to Hal, who is hanging on line two. Oh, but he lived in Chairs, and as you said, and I hope he'll give us a call back at 414-1234. And by the way, if it's a long distance from you to us, it's 800-926-8809 here for Perspectives. If you're just joining us, we're talking to the author of a brand new book on the saga of Benjamin Chairs called Whispers of Verdura, The Legacy of Benjamin Chairs. That's Sharon Hyland Shields, and also from Tallahassee Community College's Department of History, Bob Holliday has joined us too on Perspectives as we talk about this part of our history. When you go into the then legacy of chairs, besides the 35 grandkids and the multiple offspring from that extensive brood, Sharon, what else besides that legacy, the progeny, did Benjamin Chairs leave in this
area? Well, actually, the title is The Lost Legacy of Benjamin Chairs. And the reason I chose to name it that is because many of the projects that he was involved in during his life either were forgotten not long after he died, or there were larger forces at work that caused what could have been a legacy to just sort of fade away. For example, his work with the railroads, he was an absolutely gung-ho railroad guy. He believed in it as a method of getting the produce from the plantations from the Leon County area down to the coast. And then from the coast, they could ship the cotton out to England, to New York, to New Orleans. And so he really had his ideas for transporting the cotton and increasing the trade of the rest of the world with this part of the world. If that had continued after his death, the coast of Florida, or at least our part of the coast, would have been an absolute depot for shipping. But he died, and with his death, no one else had the energy, the excitement, the commitment to that method of trade or increasing trade. And so it just went away. They ended up selling all of the equipment. They sold the land, and it just died. And to this day, there is no railroad.
Well, I think the first railroad in Florida, wasn't it the St. Marks, the Tallahassee to St. Marks Railroad?
Yes, but this was much larger than that. This, I'm sorry, I didn't explain it well. This was called the Lake Wimico Railroad and Canal Company, and it was enacted by the Legislative Council, I think around 34.
But before the Civil War.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was dead long before the Civil War.
Okay, hold that thought. I want to pursue that a little bit further. Is the what might have been had the legacy of Benjamin Chairs continued on the trajectory that it was when he passed on in 1838. And we're talking about The Whispers of Verdura, The Lost Legacy of Benjamin Chairs by Sharon Hyland Shields here on Perspectives. 414-1234. If you have a question or comment, 800-926-8809, or drop us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. Back on Perspectives on WFSU-FM, and a reminder, you can always find the program online at WFSU.org. Just go to WFSU.org, click on Radio, pull down the Programs menu, and click Perspectives, because we archive past shows, try to have the latest program up within a few hours of when it actually airs. So if you missed any of today's program, you can go back and listen to it in its entirety. Let's check in with Jake here. He wants to get some time frame here on our saga of Benjamin Chairs and some of the other luminaries of early Florida history that surrounded his point in time. Hey, Jake, how you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for passing on the show.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that, sir.
Yes. Well, when your guest mentioned slavery as being both legal, constitutional, and immoral, that kind of reminded me of Citizens United of today. But my question is, was there any relationship or the time frame with Flagler, who we know brought the railroad down to South Florida? And what was the difference in time frame between Flagler's time spend taxpayers' time?
Well, Benjamin Chares lived from 1786 to 1838, and he was active during the very beginning of railroads in Florida. And the one that I was referring to before the break, the Lake Wimico, went down from a place called Cotton, Florida, Cotton, and to St. Joseph. And that created a big rivalry between Apalachicola, which was already a port, and St. Joseph, which we know as Port St. Joe, which Chares and others of his persuasion were interested in turning into a port unto itself, which is a whole other story. But the Flagler was much later, and that was during Victorian.
It was late 19th and early 20th century. I think you probably finished that railroad about 1912, 1913, something like that.
Yeah, considerably after that. Yeah. But Benjamin Chares could have been one of the first of the great railroad barons then of the South. I mean, the Cornelius Vanderbilt of Tallahassee, maybe. Who knows?
Well, it does. That does raise an interesting sort of larger question here, and I won't spend much time on this, but historians have been debating one of the great historical controversies about the antebellum South is whether the antebellum South was capitalist or not, whether it was part of the capitalist economy. Because when you think of capitalism, you tend to think of capital, of course, but also free labor, the ability of a mobile labor force and so forth. And so there is an entire historical branch which argues, no, the antebellum South was not capitalist per se because of the institution of slavery, but there's an equally and maybe even larger branch that argues that's crazy because it's clear that because of cotton demand and railroads and everything else that the antebellum South was as much a part of Atlantic world capitalism, if that's what you want to call it, as the shipping industry or textile mills or anything else. A major controversy. I mean, I will agree with you. Benjamin Chares sounds awfully much like a corporate capitalist to me.
Yeah, the only thing being that the means of production, or a large chunk of the means of production being the actual human beings that were the slaves, were not part of the capitalist economy, and that they did not have any kind of income that then could be used to purchase other goods and services and do that. They were like a cotton gin or something.
They were property.
They were inanimate objects as far as the economy was concerned.
Yeah. Right.
Really, except for what they did.
I would like to make another point about the railroad that Chares was involved with. It actually foundered, and they had to regroup, and they started a new rebuilding project, which was for the Eola Railroad Company. And that was just a different part of the Apalachicola River where they built their warehouses and which was the end run for the railroad. The reason that the railroad ultimately failed was because Ben Chares died and there was no one to take his place, that it had the exuberance that he had for building the railroad. It was so important to him that he actually turned down being a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. And he just said, I can't do it. I've got to get the railroad finished.
I think that's interesting. What would have happened if Ben Chears had been at that convention? Yeah.
But they had enormous problems. The swamps, the snakes, the bugs, the Indians were lurking. The slaves were running away with the Indians. They would have to constantly regroup. After they would reach a certain point, They'd get the cotton on these big steamers, paddle-wheeled steamers, to ship them, in some cases, north to Columbus, Georgia. But they would get stuck in the mud, and they would just be loaded down with these huge bales of cotton, and they couldn't do anything with them because they were stuck in the mud. And it must have been just incredible.
Yeah, we forget that, I mean, with routes like I-10 right up here through Tallahassee, how big a challenge transportation of product was in the day.
One of Benjamin Scheer's, one of the most interesting things about Benjamin Scheer's to me is his involvement with William Duval in trying to, trying to eliminate the Indian presence in Florida, because Duval was, I mean, everybody involved with the Jacksonians in the 1830s, late 1820s, trying to get the Seminoles out of Florida. And they're doing it by coercion. They're trying to doing it by, of course, going to war with them. But Benjamin Scheer's, I guess, made a fair amount of money feeding the
Indians. He did.
Yeah.
He provided rations for the Indians that were placed on the reservation, which extended from about Ocala to Port Charlotte, and it was 15 miles in from both coasts. And they had a real problem with slaves running away to live with the Indians, and that was an ongoing issue. But he did provide rations. There was a whole sort of scandal with Governor Duval, because Governor Duval tried to make contracts for the rations for his friends, and he got found out, and that was a whole thing that blew up.
Are you saying that there was backdoor politics and all kinds of chicanery going on even back in the
Isn't
day?
That amazing?
Favoritism in government contracts? How shocking.
Yeah. I'm amazed. Barbara joins us on line one. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for calling. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I was a little shocked to hear that because people believed in slavery at the time it was going on, that it wasn't going to be discussed. I understand the book is not about slavery per se, but there were so many Southerners, and you can read their diaries, Mary Chestnut among many, many others, or divided family members who did it, who supported it because of economic reasons, just as people have done other things for economic reasons. But to say that everybody believed in it, I know you didn't say everybody, but the people believed in it. No, there was dissension. There was a psychological toll on many of the slave owners. And obviously it was a problem for the slaves. And to say that nobody now knows it firsthand, no, I don't know it firsthand, but I did know a great-grandmother in Cuba who lived on a plantation with slaves. It's not that distant, although we have many tools to move forward.
Yes, absolutely, Barbara. And it does exist in many parts of the world, even to this day, which
yes.
which we think is just horrific, of course.
Right.
I don't think Sharon said
the nature of the slavery in other areas is different from the nature of the slavery in the United States. There was practically no way of getting free.
Well, I don't think Sharon said, and I can guarantee you the book does not say that slavery was a benign institution.
No. What she said was that everybody believed in it. I think that's my main issue. Or everybody accepted it, believed that it was right. And I just think there were too many Southerners who may or may not have taken any action who had great qualms or did take action and did not believe in it.
Well, that may be, but slavery, I mean, it took
prevailed.
A civil war to end slavery.
Yes.
Southerners were not able to end it.
Right, and I do think the reasons are economic. But in the South, and again, we know we didn't have slavery in the North for very long because it wasn't economically feasible.
Well, the only Florida planter that I know of who was outspokenly anti-slavery was Zephaniah Kingsley over in Jacksonville.
Uh-huh.
And Kingsley, of course, married one of his slaves. And Kingsley was actually involved with Chairs in some litigation and so forth. But Kingsley was persona non grata, frankly, throughout most of Florida, and ended up having to take his family to Haiti in order to escape the situation here.
That is interesting. Of course, they didn't have slavery in Haiti at that time. I just discovered I'm a blue-eyed blonde descendant of a Haitian slave. So
wow.
Things happen. But thank you very much for your show. I am learning a great deal about the area here in Tallahassee.
Oh, Barbara, it's so nice for you to join us, and thank you for calling. We really appreciate that, too. Something else that you touched on, Bob Holliday, that I thought was interesting, that even though the North certainly had far more of an abolitionist bent throughout this entire period of history, so many industries and parts of the Northern economy were also dependent on slavery, not because they employed slaves in production, but because what they got from the South in terms of whether it was grist for the textile mills or anything else were products of slaves as well.
Well, in 1860, the year before the Civil War started, it's quiz time, Professor Holliday's quiz time. What percentage of total U.S. exports was cotton in 1860? Take a guess.
Oh, gosh, I missed that chapter in the book. I'm sorry. I didn't. 63%.
It's 60%. 60% of all U.S. exports were cotton. So cotton and the slavery that fueled it very largely drove the U.S. economy.
And that is a historic reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, which is why New York City, at the beginning of the Civil War, there was considerable talk in New York City about either New York seceding or declaring neutrality, becoming a neutral city, because so much of the cotton shipments went through the port of New York, as well as the brokerage houses and everything else. There were strong economic ties.
And not all slave ships came south of the Mason-Dixon line.
Well, slavery—that's true. I mean, the international slave trade was, of course, illegal by 1860. It had been outlawed in 1808, and there is some dispute as to the true extent of what we call the illegal slave trade. But we know that if you are a planter in the Upper South, like Virginia or Kentucky or Tennessee, from roughly 1810 on, and maybe your land is worn out from tobacco production or something like that, and you need to stay in the lifestyle to which you are accustomed, one way to do it is to sell your surplus slaves. A multi-million dollar industry is something called the domestic slave trade, which starts in the Upper South and goes to all of these Gulf Coast states, including Florida. In fact, it's undoubtedly true, I think, that Benjamin Shares, one reason he's going back and forth to Savannah, is he's buying slaves on the domestic slave trade.
Let's see if we can wind up here with Adam, who is joining us here on Line 2 in Perspectives. Hi, Adam. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, having recently moved to the Panhandle, this is a great piece y'all are discussing this morning, and my question was, is my understanding that the Panhandle was some of the last frontier, if you will, of Florida, and I wanted to kind of get your take on what did Mr. Chairs know that made him a visionary as far as the resources of this place. You alluded earlier that it was swampy and insects and maybe not the best agriculture land. What kind of resources did he see, and kind of what got him here?
Sharon, what did you find in your research there as to, you know, what made him say, boy, this is the place. I'm slopping up as much land as I can here.
Okay. The reference to the swamps and everything were more toward the coast when they were working on the railroad and having to slog through all of that to get that done. His initial interest in this part of Florida, I think, was twofold. I think he had heard about the conditions here, which was a lot of clean water available. There was not used up land. If you were going to clear the forests for planting cotton or other crops, the land was fresh, it was new, it was clean. And so I think that was probably something that interested him. But also, right before he decided to come over here and explore, there was a pronouncement that the United States government was going to sell land in Middle Florida at $1.25 an acre. And that was a mighty big temptation, I think, for somebody who sort of by nature was interested in acquiring a lot of land, but to find it at prices like that, I think, was probably a temptation too great to ignore.
I would imagine so. $1.25 an acre. Bob Holliday, real quick, how do we get a hold of the book?
CenturyPress@gmail.com. Send me an email. You'll be put on the list and you will be contacted.
That's Bob Holliday, also joined by the author of the work, Whispers of Verdure, The Lost Legacy of Benjamin Chairs, Sharon Highland Shields. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Perspectives produced by WFSU FM in Tallahassee. Taylor and Lydell handling things today, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Next week, our annual holiday music special with guest DJ, Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra conductor and music director Darko Buderak. We'll see you then.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.